Octa Non Verba is a show that's raw and real, featuring hard-hitting interviews with people that live by the ethos of actions, not words. Marcus Aurelius Anderson is a TEDx speaker, best-selling author, veteran, and leadership and mindset coach. With this show, you get to join Marcus as he goes inside the minds and experiences of the world's most successful warriors, leaders, entrepreneurs, and experts. With each episode, you're going to get the philosophies, concepts, tactics, and strategies these leaders use to turn adversity into victory. Live an extraordinary life based on actions, not words. Now, here's your host, Marcus Aurelius Anderson.
Octa Non Verba is a Latin phrase that means actions, not words. If you want to know what somebody truly believes, don't listen to their words. Instead, observe their actions. I'm Marcus Aurelius Anderson, and my guest today truly embodies that phrase. Kelly Harrison is an award-winning helicopter pilot, retired Navy commander, executive and team coach, and highly in-demand keynote speaker. On a dark night in 2007, she found herself at the controls of a helicopter that lost its tail rotor. She and her team had to do everything that they could to survive that night. She honed her collaborative leadership style in many high-stakes leadership positions during her 21 years in service, as well as the technology startup and in the boardroom. Kelly, this is your first interview, and I am honored to be part of that. Thank you so much for being here today, and thank you for all the work you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to get the opportunity to chat with you, and I'm just elated that you reached out to connect. So thanks for the invitation.
Well, thank Mark McGrath as well, because he had many great things to say about you. If you guys don't know who Mark is, first of all, shame on you. Go back and listen to our podcast interview. And to give him a quick shout out, if you want to know anything about the OODA loop, if you want to truly understand the OODA loop, truly understand VUCA, go back and listen to our interview. Go check out his podcast, No Way Out. He and Ponch do a great job unpacking that. And as a matter of fact, I used one of the examples that I learned from him in one of my workshops this weekend, and it was very easy for people to grasp, and people were saying, wow, that's the best way I've ever heard it before. It makes a lot of sense. And I say, good, now go follow Mark McGrath, because I learned it from him. So
Mark is awesome. Yes. And I'm really glad he connected us. That's great that he's like given you something tangible to use in your workshops. No surprise.
I was going to say there's no surprise at all. And it's incredible what happens when we truly understand the depth and the breadth of what we're trying to intake. So you were in for 21 years. Can you tell us about the impetus that made you want to join in the first place?
Oh, absolutely. My father was a career naval officer, and we moved around a bunch from when I was a child, but that gave me the opportunity to see a lot of different places, which I really loved. I also had the strong desire to be a student at the University of Notre Dame, which is where I eventually graduated from. But in order to have the resources to, you know, be able to attend that university, I needed to find some help. And so I researched a lot of different options. I told my high-ranking naval officer father that I wanted to join the Air Force because the women's uniforms were better. And then as I continued to research the different ROTC programs, I realized that the Navy really had the best deal and the best duty stations. And that's where I felt I would belong. And so I applied, I was accepted, and the rest is history.
Wow. And when did you enlist?
So I joined the Notre Dame ROTC unit in 1996. And then I graduated from Notre Dame in 2000. I was commissioned with the rest of my class that graduated then, and then went on to Great Lakes to be stashed because flight school was a little bit backed up, which was a great experience for me. And then went on to flight school, and my first duty station was in Jacksonville, Florida, with the Mighty Dragon Slayers of HS-11, now HSC.
Wow. And so dare I say that your first taste of leadership came from your father?
I think that's extremely fair to say. My family, on both sides, actually, my mom's side and my dad's side, has a really strong connection to service. So my mother's father was one of the first 10 frogmen So the fathers of the SEALs, wow. UDT officers.
Yeah.
And he was actually the last one to retire. He was referred to as MacArthur's Frogman. So there's a lot of pride on that side of the family. My uncle, my mom's brother, served in the Marine Corps in Vietnam. And then, you know, she married my father, her sisters. I believe all but one of them married service members. And then on my dad's side, my father is one of nine children. And so he had six brothers and two sisters. All of his brothers went into service in some way. Most of them were in the Navy. One of them was in the Air Force. He was the black sheep. And four of them went to the Naval Academy. The oldest was the first one to go. And my father actually enlisted first, went to Great Lakes, and then was granted a spot at the Naval Academy. So he went to the Naval Academy and served for, oh man, I want to say 35 or 36 years.
Wow. So, truly career officer. Yeah.
And I have lots of cousins in service in various ways, like in government service in various ways. And both my sisters and I joined the Navy.
Wow. So it's literally in your blood.
It is the family business.
The family business all the way around.
Yes.
Now, before we talk about that dark evening in 2007, you've experienced leadership in many different capacities from many different angles and avenues of approach, so to speak. Can you tell me what the biggest misconception that you see continually repeated about leadership is?
Oh, it's so interesting. I think there are a lot, and I have two, but yeah, I will please. Choose one of them today.
No, please tell me two, but just tell me in priority and secondary.
Okay, so I would say in priority order, the most common misconception about leadership is that you have to be the expert and do it all yourself. And I think that the most rewarding aspect of leadership, and I actually just posted about this on LinkedIn recently, is when you really embrace the ability to empower the folks that you're serving as their leader. And then you get to sit back and watch them do amazing things. And, you know, it's really hard to get there. It took me a really long time in my Commandor. And I'm lucky that my department heads and my XO were very patient with me and, you know, gave me really valuable feedback along the way that helped me shape who I was. My command master chief was also really skilled at kind of helping shape me as a leader. And I just think it is the best feeling in the world to realize that nobody needs you anymore, that they can all do it themselves. I think there is a quote by Lao Tzu.
Yes.
That really embodies that concept. There's a quote that's often quoted that is much shorter, but the whole poem is really valuable for leaders to take a look at.
Yes, we're going to find out.
I don't have it off the top of my head. Do you want me to like look it up and call it out really quick? Is that valuable?
If you'd like to, absolutely. Or I know the small quote off the top of my head, but.
Oh, great. Let's do it. Go ahead.
And I believe the quote that you're referring to is this notion that the best leader is the one where the people say, hey, look, we did it all by ourselves. We didn't need any help. Is that correct?
Yes, that is the punchline. So I think that is the most common misconception, especially when people are just getting started on their journey from transitioning from managers to leaders. And then the next one to me is, I believe that relationships are undervalued. And what I mean by that is not just the relationship from like mentor to protege or leader to direct report. It's all about leaders to leaders. So the people that are, you know, doing the same things that you are, that are attempting to overcome the same obstacles that you are, those are extremely valuable resources when you're in a leadership position. And I think that we often don't do enough to keep ourselves connected in those circles and rely on one another. So when I was in command, there is a period of time where we were struggling with aircraft availability. So the ability to launch aircraft and go and perform the training missions that we needed to do. And a lot of our training missions required two aircraft to fly at the same time. And so if you can't get two aircraft to rub together to go fly, then you can't complete your training missions. And so I reached out to my colleagues and asked for help. I asked for help in the form of instructors, aircraft that we could fly, or even if they wanted to have their pilots perform a dual ship card in the other aircraft, then at least we could join up and be able to have two aircraft flying. And so those creative solutions that you can put your heads together with your colleagues and say, hey, I'm really struggling here. I need some help. Can we come up with a solution together? Those are really valuable conversations. And I think sometimes they're forgotten about.
Both of those are great points. And to your first point, that idea of that Master Chief and that XO, very much as leaders, is easy for us to just say, I can do this better. I'm more efficient. Let me do this. But it robs you of the opportunity of repetitions, of experience, of becoming a leader. And now that, as you say, that stops you from being able to acquire that skill set. And then what else does it do? It robs you of the opportunity to create more trust, a better relationship, more rapport. And as leaders, especially today, we have to have more of that.
I think there's one other really big thing mm-hmm. that it robs you of. It robs you of the ability to feel comfortable leaving. And I'm not saying leaving for good. I'm saying taking that time off that is so necessary for leaders to take. And so when you build out the team that supports you and you understand how much like capacity and expertise they have, it makes it much easier for you to step away and really trust that they're going to make the decisions in alignment with the course that you've set out, the mission and the purpose and the vision that you have for your organization. And that white space, I think that is something a lot of leaders really struggle with. And it impacts not only your professional life, but your personal life as well. Your ability to enjoy recreation, to have fun with your family, which is so important, especially when you have little ones, to be able to go out on a snow day and go sledding like I did yesterday. you know, these are it's important to have that time and that space to do those things.
And what else are you doing when you do that? You empower your people, because if they get to the point where you're micromanaging and you're the bottleneck and everything, then you're teaching them, hey, I want you to sit and wait to be told what to do. I don't want you to be proactive. I don't want you to go out and try to find opportunities to improve this. And now you have this docile environment, which ironically, those are the same leaders that often are aggravated. It feels like, I'm the only one that does anything over here. And nobody, and everybody's reactionary. It's like, well, you've literally taught them that in your actions and your words as well.
Yes. I mean, ask me how I know. I've been there, right? Like, nobody becomes an incredible leader from the day that they're born. It is a process. And so I think that those relationships, asking for help, acknowledging what your strengths are and the strengths of the other folks around you who can also, you know, contribute to achieving that mission and purpose. Those are all important things to keep in mind.
Absolutely. So in 2007, you had an experience that, dare I say, changed your life and the life of many other people. Can you tell us about what that was and just walk us through all of it? Because your story is powerful. And as I told you before we started recording, we need to be able to get these experiences from somebody firsthand. That's where the real quality comes in, as opposed to just regurgitating the story from somebody else or Googling a story from somebody else historically that did something. Anyone can do that. Anyone can parrot something else, or anybody can connect the dots after the fact. But in 2007, you had an experience that truly tested your mettle. And I dare I say, you rose to the occasion and beyond.
Thank you. Yeah, I know that is the main purpose of me being here. And I am excited to share that story. On November 9th, 2007, I was tagged as a junior officer who was an instructor pilot to go out and join the carrier, which was undergoing an exercise called Comp2X, which is important just in the fact that it was complicated. There were a lot of forces out there working together and also forces serving as opposing forces. So there was a lot of like complicated movements happening. And so the mission that we were going on was complicated. It was a long-range CSAR, combat search and rescue. We had two F-18 gentlemen who served as survivors who were actually located in the Chocolate Mountains, way inland, right near California and Arizona border in the desert. So we launched from the carrier. We went out, we got gas, we executed that mission at night, got gas again, and then we were on our way back to the ship. So we'd been flying for about 6.5 hours. We had about 45 minutes to go. We were all relaxing. We had gotten pizza to refuel ourselves when we refilled the helicopter.
Nice.
And so we were full and we were ready to get back and, you know, rehash and unpack the mission that we've just flown. The TACAN swings in, so we know we've got about 40 more minutes of flight left to get back to the ship. We're out over water. That night, it was no moon. There was an overcast layer of clouds, so there was no starlight that we could see. We were flying on night vision goggles. We were flying at 200 feet, and so it was pretty challenging conditions. We like to call it flying into pea soup. We were in Dash 2, so we had a wingman with us. It happened to be the CO and the officer of the squadron. And all of a sudden, you know, when we're almost home, there was a shudder throughout the aircraft. And everything just started to feel funny. I was not at the controls. My co-pilot, Chick, was at the controls. And naturally, being a sarcastic pilot, I started to give him a hard time because I looked down and the ball, which is the indicator of whether the aircraft is flying in balanced flight, which the pilot at the controls has control over, was indicated that we were way out of balance. And so I told him, hey, the ball's knocking on the side of the aircraft. Are you going to do something about it? And he said, I know, I'm trying, and I can't fix it. So at that point, I took the controls. I pushed the pedals through the full range of motion and got no response from the aircraft. So normally that would make the nose move left and right, and it didn't do that. And so we knew something was wrong. I called out to our wingman and said, hey, I think we have some flight control issues. And, you know, naturally being two really experienced pilots, they asked me immediately, what sort of flight control issues? And the aircraft wasn't really behaving in a textbook manner. So we weren't exactly sure what was going on. And so I just responded. I said, no, I think we have a loss of tail rotor control. Because that was what made the most sense to me. We couldn't make the pedals move. And so internally, we discussed our options. We elected to turn around and head back to the runway on shore. And once we turned around, I was so relieved that we had done that because it was like, you know, the scene where the music comes on and everyone's so excited because there's something that happens that's great. And the thing that happened that was great was all the lights of San Diego formed a false horizon for us. The flying at that point became much easier. So that was great. Our wingman turned around and followed us back. And at that point, the aircraft shuddered again and this noise started like a broomstick going through a garbage disposal. The noise intensified over time. The aircraft shuddered again. And then the aircraft went silent. And so we had already climbed up because when that grinding noise started, we also got a chip light, tail rotor chip light, which means that we're switching from a loss of tail rotor control situation to a loss of tail rotor drive, which means that if you don't perform the emergency procedure immediately and accurately, once you actually do lose drive, the aircraft goes into a flat spin similar to those teacups at Disney World with an insane 13-year-old boy at the helm. And then you're no longer have like flight characteristics. So the aircraft will just sink like a brick. We don't have ejection seats. So we stay with that aircraft all the way to the water. And so when the aircraft shuddered again, the aircraft got silent and started to spin. We entered the auto rotation. I called auto, auto, auto over the radios. So that the other aircraft would know exactly what we had done. Chick did everything that he needed to do on that checklist. So there's, you know, an 11-step checklist or something, 10 or 11-step checklist. Half of the steps are required to get done, probably more than that, by the pilot and out at the controls, which was Chick. He got all those steps done perfectly in accordance with the brief, which was actually really important. Because I had briefed things a little different than he was used to doing, but he still did it in accordance with the brief, which meant when he pulled the engines off, I did not you know, I knew exactly where we were kind of in the timeline. So we do the auto rotation. When we get to the bottom, the water is rushing up towards the aircraft much faster than I want it to be. And we're also moving a lot faster. Per the textbook, you're supposed to level the aircraft in the recovery. But because we were still moving at a good clip, I improvised and decided to pull the nose up a little bit to see if we could make the aircraft slow down just a little bit more. Things worked out for us that night, luckily, and we impacted the water. The tail flipped up over the nose, and we were immediately underwater and upside down. And the water rushed into the aircraft really quickly. Part of that is because one of the steps that Chick did perfectly was that he got his window out. And the sound that that made me jealous. So I got my window out while we were while I was flying the auto rotation. And so we had a ton of water in the aircraft almost immediately. And we had to, each of us had to do our egress. And this is where things got interesting for me.
Because up to this point, it wasn't interesting at all. You're right.
Well, because up to this point, there is, you have all of this training to rely on, and you're kind of, lack of a better term, on autopilot and executing. Now I'm underwater and upside down, and thinking, like, as I'm about to impact the water, thinking to myself, like, oh man, this is really going to suck. Like, I wonder if we're going to get out of this, you know? And I had borrowed someone's gear, and it was too big for me. And I could not find my breathing device. So I panicked. And aviation is by the book. We have procedures for everything. We have a procedure for how to get out of a helicopter when it's upside down and underwater. And so when I panicked, I did not do that procedure correctly. I went straight to unbuckling my harness. I tumbled inside the aircraft. I didn't have a reference point. And so I am floating and I don't know where I am and it's dark. And so I just sweep my hands out to the sides. And luckily, my left hand grabbed the one thing in the aircraft that's shaped distinctly, and that is our power control lever, which is shaped like a lollipop. So I knew where that was in the aircraft, and I swept my hand in the other direction as far as I could reach and ended up grabbing the edge of the window. And so once I got the edge of the window, I pulled to get myself out of there, but I'd forgotten another step. And when I pulled to get myself out of there, my cords pulled me back into the aircraft. So I had to disconnect my cords, and then I was able to finally get myself out of the aircraft. Now I'm in deep water. It's dark. I don't know which direction is up. And when you're in survival training, they teach you that all you have to do is blow air out of your mouth and then follow the bubbles. It's really simple, right? I wasn't about to get rid of my air because I, at this point, you know, I'm like, I don't have anything left to give. But I saw a light and I was like, that better be the right light. And so I start swimming toward the light. And the light turned out to be our wingman's aircraft. They were already in a hover over us and shining a light on the scene to commence the rescue. They had their rescue light on. So I pop up, take a big breath of delicious air, and look around me and start to see seven helmets popping up in the water around me. And we all join up and, you know, I think it was 45 minutes to an hour later, we're all on board our wingman's aircraft, flying back to the ship for medical purposes. And a lot of people hear that story and they think to themselves, wow, that's an incredible story. And everyone survived. You know, it makes it so much easier to tell the story because everyone survived. It turned out we did most things right. You know, nobody ever does everything correctly. Everyone survived. Like, it is the best possible outcome for something like this. But that, for me, was really just the beginning of the story. And the reason I say that is because we got back to the ship and that kicked off a series of investigations. We got, you know, tons of vials of blood taken, urinalysis, tox screen, blood sugar levels, evaluated for how much sleep we'd had, you know, historically. And essentially, the investigation itself to determine whether we had done the right thing took 18 months. I had friends calling me like, are you sure you did the right thing? I doubted myself. I couldn't, you know, I'm in writing my statement immediately after getting back to the ship. And I can't remember which chip light came on. I had to like pull out my NATOPS. I remembered which side it was on. I had to pull out my NATOPS just to like back myself up that I was remembering the right thing. We all remembered things just a little bit differently, which I think is pretty normal in these types of situations. But all of that combined to, you know, create a lot of self-doubt. And then the report comes out. We find out we had done the right thing. It was like this huge sense of relief for all of us. And then I keep reading and I read one of the endorsements and it said, she had seven souls in the palm of her hands. And from the outside, somebody would look at that and be like, that's great. You know, you've got all this support from the community. And I had so much support from everyone involved. For me, though, the event put me into this position that I was really uncomfortable in. And I started to worry that people were like viewing me as better than I actually was, because ultimately we're all human, right? And so that, I think it was a tough like thing for me throughout the rest of my career to worry all the time, like, oh, I have to make sure I do this right because that's what people expect of me.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people get into those situations. I think there are a lot of people out there that feel that way. You know, their work is their identity. They feel like it needs to be perfect all the time because that's what they should be doing. And I think when we let go of that, we actually do ourselves a huge service.
Well, dare I say that had you worried about perfection in the heat of that adversity, there's no way you would have been able to adapt the way that you did in real time. You're underwater, you just impacted. Things aren't going the way you need to. You have this SOP, you're trained. And anybody that's been in the military understands, like you said, when we would do rollover training, anything to do with weapons, room clearing, et cetera, you'll hear, you know, soldiers say that. My training took over, which is why we trained at that level. But then having the capacity and the wherewithal in real time to figure out where's my orientation, where's a reference point for me, because that's literally what was the difference between life or death for you.
Well, and I think that perseverance, right? And the realization, like, I didn't do the procedure correctly, but you don't have to be perfect to succeed.
And if you just sit there and beat yourself up mentally in the middle of that, oh, I did it wrong. It's like, no, we don't have that luxury. I need to figure it out.
Right. Well, and so I think a lot about, I mean, I have done a lot of processing about this, and that's why I'm comfortable, you know, talking about it and giving speeches about it and sharing the things that I think are important from the things that I've learned in hindsight. But one of the things, and the main thing for me, when everything first started, there was this feeling that it felt familiar. And I when I got back to my house after, you know, getting off the ship, and I had some time to kind of process independently, because when you're on a ship, you're always with, you know, thousands of your friends, I realized that I had a commanding officer when I was a JO who used to tell us a story. And the story that he told us was about a time when he was flying during the daytime. He found himself abeam in an airfield in North Carolina, I believe, North or South Carolina. And the aircraft shuddered. And he had to land the aircraft. And when he landed or in the process of landing, the tail rotor started acting wonky. But initially, it started as a loss of tail rotor control. And so I called him up at that point, you know, like shortly after getting back from the ship. And I didn't tell him what had happened. And I asked him to tell me that story again. And there was a point in his retelling of the story where he said, the sound started like a broomstick going through a garbage disposal. And I had, and at that point I was like, this is the same emergency. We had the same emergency. And it, you know, he would tell us that story because it wasn't something that was codified in NATOPS. It wasn't like a normal failure mode of the helicopter. And when he finished telling his story, he said, "I heard you had a bit of a wild ride." And so at that point, I was like, okay, I'm going to ask him everything that I'm worried about investigations and what it's like and all this stuff. And I barraged him with a lot of questions. Some of them he could answer, some of them he couldn't because his experiences were a little bit different. But for me, looking back, it is so important to share the hard parts of your story because you never know when it's going to become just like a lifeline for someone, even if it's subconscious. And so that emergency, it's happened twice in the Navy and it happened a handful of times in the Army, that failure mode, the battle gear coming apart. And he and I had the same emergency. The investigation came out and it was the same failure mode of the helicopter. Crazy, right?
So glad you were paying attention to that story.
I'm so glad he was willing to share the story.
And again, that comes back to that point that you're making. It's very easy for us to put people on pedestals. Oh, look at this person. They're this. Look at this person. They're successful. This person's great at what they did. Look at what Kelly did. She did great in that situation. But as you say, one, that's not fair because we're all human. We all fail. Any person that we put on a pedestal, if you look at them quickly and long enough, you'll see that there's humanity there. More importantly, I believe that it's a cop-out. If I see somebody, put somebody on a pedestal and I see them do something extraordinary, then I say, well, that's because it's this person or that's what they do. But the reality is every single one of us as human beings, we are all facing some sort of hardship. And just like you said, this is an incredible experience that you survived and that everyone survived, frankly. Having said that, like you said, the impact and the repercussions for you were different with this idea of now there's this fear that I have this standard or expectation that I've established by just surviving and doing what you should do as a leader. And now, in some ways, that inhibited your capacity to do other things as you move forward. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. I think sometimes that feeling would creep in and cause me to make decisions or act from a place of fear of, instead of, just being confident that I could rely on my training and rely on the stories that people told me, rely on my colleagues and the people I had built relationships with. I mean, as I went on in my career, I made some bad calls, just like anyone does. But for me, those were really hard to deal with. And in hindsight, it's helpful just to know in your bones that like no one experience, decision, or action defines you. Your whole story is made up of all of these experiences and joyful times and hard times. And it's important to share all of it because that's what can be helpful to others. Understanding how you got through those hard times can be so helpful.
Couldn't agree more. And before we hit record, you and I were discussing how that we see a lot now on social media or whatever it is, where it's just very much the superficial highlight of, here's the 30 seconds of what happened and this is blah, blah, blah. But, I got through it and I'm awesome and, you should listen to me. But there's not a whole lot of depth to that. That's very, in my opinion, there's so much of that out there. What you're talking about is, I love that you were discussing the idea that you really didn't have time to even be afraid as this was happening in real time because it was going on so quickly. And luckily, if we refer back to what Mark McGrath talks about, your OODA loop, your orientation set you up to know all these SOPs, to know what to do. And even when it broke down, you were still able to adapt in real time. So you weren't having to say, oh, I'm at this part of the loop. It's like, no, once you understand what needs to be done, your decision and action just naturally follow almost simultaneously. And that quick thinking is what saved you and probably the other people in the crew in many ways. But you said that you may have experienced more fear afterwards than in the actual event.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I think it came and went. I mean, think about the decisions that you've made and the hard situations you've been in. And I'm sure there's been times where you've acted when you've been afraid of something or afraid of some outcome. And I think those are typically the places where I mean, not always, but can be the places where we'll make a mistake because we're not just confident in our OODA loop, I guess. And I think the Navy does a really great job, especially in aviation, setting you up for success, giving you all the tools that you need to succeed in one of those situations. You know, flight school is no picnic, no walk in the park, and that's all for good reason. You have to go to water survival every 4 years. That's all for good reason. And I think those opportunities can be really challenging, but it's everything is for a reason. And it when you don't phone it in during all those things, you can set yourself up for success when you really need it to count.
That's a powerful story. So you were saying that that's what kind of got you through this entire thing was that preparation, this training, not phoning it in, taking it seriously. But then afterwards,
the stories.
Now that you've unpacked it and you're speaking to people in these keynotes and you're preparing to do all these other things, what is the biggest question that you're asked over and over again, would you say?
Well, I don't know that there's like a question that repeats itself, because sometimes when I get a question, I'll try to incorporate the answer into my speech so the questions change.
Of course.
But probably the most interesting question I got recently was what advice I would give to someone who is kind of struggling with their career and understanding where it is that they want to go with their life. And they asked it in preface. They said, you know, it's clear that you really, really loved your job as a pilot. And so I said, you know, it's interesting. And in the question, she said, what advice would you give a young person who doesn't know what they want to do with their life? And I said, you know, I'm an old person and I have no idea what I want to do with my life. And I think that I have come forward from that point and I am going in a much more narrowed direction. But leaving the military, you have this great opportunity where you get to choose what it is that you do with your life. And it's also a huge challenge because it's the first time where you get to choose what you do with your life. And so I found myself exploring a lot of different things. I found myself understanding more about myself. So when I first left, I joined a tech startup, as you mentioned. And a lot of the reasons that I left the military were showing up again in my role in the tech startup. And that was honestly, just kind of comes down to time bankruptcy as like the primary. I was dedicating everything to my job. I was my identity was aligned to my job, and so I ended up leaving. And when I left, I decided to take a little bit of time off. I started teaching Pilates because I had gotten my Pilates certification during COVID as a passion project, and then I started learning to play golf. Learning, love of learning is one of my top five strengths. And so that kind of fit there. And as I started exploring other things, I started taking speaking opportunities. I realized, I kept asking myself, like, why do I love teaching Pilates so much? Why do I not want to let go of this? And the answer was the light bulb moment. So as an instructor, as a flight instructor, as a leader in a squadron, you're always teaching people in the aircraft. I really missed those light bulb moments where you get somebody to realize what it is that they need to do in order to do something better or learn something. And Pilates was giving me that. So I started working with my own coach and I've decided to move into becoming an executive and team coach so that I can keep helping people turn those light bulbs on. But that question just made me laugh because I really tell people that I've got ADD when it comes to what it is that I want to do with my life. And I think that's a really good thing for someone in transition, because I think when you have kind of a portfolio career, as they refer to it, you can see what you gravitate toward naturally and understand more about your strengths and your values and what you like doing and just keep doing more of that.
I couldn't agree more. And you brought up some tremendous points that transition from military to civilian sector can be difficult, whether you were in for 21 years or I was in for 3.5. But again, we have all these fantastic traits built into us from the military. But then, as you say, also the mission was always given to us by leadership. So give us a mission and we'll attack it and we'll break it down and we'll figure it out. We'll do an op order and make it happen. But sometimes the hardest point is the decision of what the mission is. But I love that you embrace this physical realm and said, this is what I enjoy. I always say that because I teach martial arts, or I've taught martial arts for a long time. I've done martial arts my whole life. And it's very similar to me. Just like I told you this weekend with that workshop, where when one teaches to learn.
Absolutely.
And the idea was, it's very edifying to teach somebody and see that light bulb go off, or to have them see it from a different vantage point that we normally wouldn't have seen. And now that helps us look at this blind spot or see this area that we wouldn't have seen before. I think I told you before also that when I was teaching it incorrectly, and I have everybody in the class reflecting back my own error, then again, what is that? That's my fault. That shows me what's going on. And I think it's beautiful because it comes back to your idea of diversity and taking these different ideas. We talk about orientations, to go back to the OODA Loop and John Boy's material from Mark McGrath. Those orientations for each of us is unique as a fingerprint, is what Mark said. And so it behooves us tremendously to have people that will not only be willing to give us those things. And I think that also when people think about diversity, they just think that you allow everyone in with no like ethics or no like requirements, but that's not at all it. It's like, listen, to be a pilot, you had to go through all this training and there was still a tremendous amount of washout. That's done for the very reasons that you survived your situation. So talk to us about diversity and why that's so important.
Thanks for bringing that up. So diversity ties in because part of the reason that I think sharing the hard parts of your story is so important is so that people can gain better perspective into that orientation that is so unique, like a fingerprint. And when we gloss over the hard parts, or we don't share the full experience that we're coming from, I think everybody loses a little bit of something in the translation. And what I mean by that is, well, I'll tell a story. When I was a JO,
junior officer.
Yes, junior officer. We were all of the junior officers, so all of the first tour pilots, so we're all green. We were given the opportunity to fly 7 helicopters from Fallon, Nevada to Jacksonville, Florida. And as you can imagine, in the helicopter, that trip takes 3 days. So, you know, it was like the kids getting the keys to the car and we're going out and we're just causing trouble as much as you can in a helicopter. But one, there was some inappropriate video played on our common frequency that we were using to talk to each other. And when we landed, the senior JO, who was in charge of everything, came over to me and said, we're handling this in the JO protection agency. So like, we're keeping it at our level, essentially. And I don't want you talking to anyone else. And I looked at him and I was like, okay, fine. But in my head, I'm like, no, I'm going to go and talk to this person because I know who did it. No secrets stay secrets long in the squadron. And so I went up to him and I just said, hey, when you did this, it made me really uncomfortable. And at first he pushed back. And I just kind of stayed with my point and explained why it made me feel uncomfortable. And he came around. And the resulting relationship that we had over the course of decades, he would like stick up for me in mixed company, kind of totally changed his perspective on like me, what I stood for. And I was able to be more myself and not worry about trying to fit in. And he was able to understand where I was coming from and like how I wanted to belong, how I wanted to feel like I belonged, and what made me feel like I didn't belong, which was, you know, those kinds of jokes or playing things on the speaker. I feel strongly that if I had left it up to that JO, or if it had ended up, you know, bubbling up to higher levels, we would have missed out on the opportunity for that relationship and for that. And I think that conversation, that honest conversation and kind of, you know, me speaking up and saying this behavior doesn't make me feel comfortable, allowed us to get to a point where we could see each other's orientation. And so, you know, I hear people saying all the time, I lost this job because this person with this genetic makeup or, you know, some other justification got it instead, and they don't deserve it. They don't have the qualifications that I have. And I think if we actually had the opportunity to sit down and talk about it, we would realize they probably do have the requisite qualifications and experiences. Diversity is actually good for the bottom line in a lot of ways. And it's important to understand that just because, especially in government roles, there are benefits given to different people or different characteristics of people, doesn't mean they don't deserve the role. And I think by sharing the background and the experiences that we go through, we're just better able to bring different sides together.
Well, and dare I say that had you not had that direct conversation with that colleague, had you just waited for the powers that be to be the ones that worked on it, one, it wouldn't have given you the opportunity to get closer, as you said it, or to build that mutual respect. But more importantly, it probably would have built even more of friction there. That would have built even more of this, because that's the kind of thing that can fester. And it begins to erode not only your relationship, but now the entire consistency of the team.
And you're right.
You have people that don't unintentionally take sides, unintentionally support, and then that inhibits or accelerates whatever their decision-making is or where their actions are. And no matter how petty that may be, in the environment that you were in, that would truly be the difference between life and death many times if you aren't careful. So nipping it in the bud, having the courage to come forward and say, this makes me uncomfortable, having the resolve to stay in the pocket, say, push back all you want, this is still the truth, this is what I felt, this is what's going on. And again, because you stayed in that position, and you were honest enough with yourself to not just cow down to it, that gave both of you this tremendous opportunity to continue to proliferate this relationship. And frankly, I think that made you both better.
It did. It definitely made me better. It was one of those formative experiences, I think. I think also, to your point, when things fester, we retreat further into our corners. We get further and further away from one another. Whereas if we would just open up and be vulnerable, say, you know, quote Brené Brown, we'll take steps closer to one another and be able to focus on the outcome that we want to achieve or the objective that we want to achieve together.
Absolutely agree. And from your story and from your experiences, you leading by example in real time, all leadership begins with self-leadership, in my opinion. I'm so humbled and honored to have you on the show to talk about these things and to be vulnerable and transparent about what happened. As you say, it would be very easy to act as if this was just another day's work, but having the time to do what you've done with it, to unpack it, to see how it's influenced you positively and negatively in some capacities, this is the human condition. This is the human experience. And it helps us learn that whatever we're going through, there is opportunity within it. At the same time, it also gives us the ability to be very honest with ourselves and say, what can I do better? Or moving forward, am I going to be courageous enough to apply what I've learned? Because lots of times, like you said, we had the situation and it's almost like a child with a hot stove. We experience it and we get away from it. Now we want to put as much distance between us and it as we can to protect ourselves. But if we can stay in that moment, stay in that pocket long enough and just sit with the wound, it becomes something almost sacred, and it becomes this potential to learn about ourselves. There may be no other opportunity in our lives to have that the way that we do, because even after the experience of coming back to it, it's still not the same. The situation has changed. The environment has changed. We have changed. Our orientation has changed. So taking that step was incredible.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the opportunity to come and speak with you today. It's been really fun.
Thank you for the conversation. So to put a bow on this, what would be some parting advice that you would give anybody in a leadership capacity, or in, as you said, a lot of people are looking for direction in some of this. I know that those are kind of divergent type questions, but I think that when I'm asked similar questions, again, we have to have experiences. We have to go out to follow things that inspire us or that we enjoy, that becomes sort of a natural proclivity. And then that naturally becomes this sphere that overlaps almost like a Venn diagram in these other areas. So like you said, that physicality from Pilates, from golf, understanding the process of mastery, understanding the technique, the repetitions, being aware of what's going on, how important that technique is so that either you don't, you know, miss the shot or you don't hurt your body trying to do Pilates. It all comes back and it overlaps and dovetails with these other experiences that you've had in the military. And now it gives you this very robust understanding of the subject matter. And Musashi says, once you see the way in one area, you start to see it broadly in every other aspect of your life.
Yeah. And I know we've talked about this because you coach as well. I also believe it is so important to really get straight on yourself first in order to be a great leader. What I mean by that is understanding what your values are, understanding what your strengths are, being very confident in like what conditions put you at your best, and then being able to surround yourself with people that round out those strengths, those experiences, and those skill sets, and realizing that you can rely on them, having the confidence to be able to rely on someone else to empower them to be able to do the job. I think it all starts with internal work. And I think, you know, like I said, leadership is learning. It's a learning journey and nobody starts out being great at it. And being willing to take chances and be in the arena is where it all starts. Giving yourself grace when you make mistakes, unpacking those mistakes, and then moving on and incorporating the lessons that you learned from your successes and your mistakes, I think is really important. And I think those lessons that you learn and the journey, like we talked about earlier, the journey that you took to get there, both of those things are really important for your protégés. And I'm not saying you need to go out and broadcast every mistake you ever made, the hardest parts of your life, all over social media or in speeches. That is not what I am advocating for. But I am advocating for thinking, being very deliberate about the people that you think certain experiences could help if they find themselves in a similar situation in the future. Thinking about the trade-offs, like what's the benefit, what's the risk? If I tell this one person this hard story that I have, what could happen that's good? And if that benefit outweighs the risk, then taking the step to take the risk to tell the story. And I think that applies in a lot of places. And I think from a diversity perspective, when you're a minority and you decide to share, you know, potentially a very painful experience with someone, there is a chance that they will not receive it in the way that you are hoping for. So it definitely takes courage to take that first step. But I would encourage you, even if the first one is not ideal, to keep trying, because it is so important that we share our experiences with each other. We need to have a much better shared understanding of like what people experience when they go through life and go through their journey.
Yeah, when we start looking at our similarities instead of our differences, we see that we are all human. We are all fallible. And that's how we learn.
Absolutely.
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 Kelly, can we follow you on LinkedIn to learn more about you, to see where you're speaking, to know what you're up to? Where else would you recommend?
Please do. Yes, absolutely. And if you would like to be added to my mailing list, you can just shoot me a message on LinkedIn. I also have a newsletter, so you can follow the newsletter. I publish something monthly. And then I will eventually my website is in work, so it will be available soon. But if you follow me on LinkedIn, you'll get all that information real time. So,
yeah. And get to her newsletter. Did you notice that she said monthly? Notice that she's not telling you that I'm going to spam your email every day and you're become callous to what I'm saying. And then you'll eventually not like me and just block me. I think that's the idea. She's talking about quality things. She writes about things of quality. So follow quality people to get quality output on your own. Kelly, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcus. This was delightful. And I'm so glad that I had my first podcast with you. So thanks for the opportunity.
Well, thank you. I hope that I spoiled you for anyone else now and you're not going to...
I'm sure you did.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Okta Nonverba. this message resonates with you, please share it out with others on social media. Hit that subscribe button and leave a review for the show anywhere you listen to podcasts. To learn more, please go to MarcusAureliusAnderson.com and join his Okta Nonverba Inner Circle to get exclusive content, news, and information. Until next time, remember, talk is cheap. Live your life based on actions, not words.